Podcast episode number 17 from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Welcome to the BenGreenfieldFitness.com podcast. This is your weekly free audio exposure to cutting edge fitness, diet, and wellness news. Hey, whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you're just trying to shed a few pounds, this podcast is going to present you with the latest exercise and nutrition content from the nation's top experts. My name is Ben Greenfield. I'm a personal trainer, certified nutritionist, and exercise, diet, and wellness guru. Each week, I'm going to be bringing you cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and wellness advice. Stay tuned for this week's podcast from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Hey, podcast listeners, this is Ben Greenfield, and I am coming to you today from Kona, Hawaii, where I am in town for the week to compete in the Hawaii Ironman World Championship of Triathlon. And while I'm here, I'm also attending the Hawaii Ironman Medical Conference, which is a large conglomerate of fitness professionals who are devoted to inspecting the latest methods in nutrition, performance, medicine as it pertains to exercise and recovery. Primarily, in today's podcast, I'm going to be bringing you some of the top tips that I've learned during the Hawaii Ironman Medical Conference. Now, I actually helped present this conference on bike fitting and the biomechanics of decreasing injury potential on the bicycle, but the actual conference went into far more detail, and the primary elements that I want to discuss today include research on how you can get way more bang for your buck out of your cardio if you're currently spending a long time doing cardio, or you find that you don't have that much time to devote to cardio but you want to get the highest amount of benefit possible out of your cardio sessions. I have some great research to bring to you on that. I'll be talking a little bit about eating before exercise and research that goes into what you should eat, how close to the exercise you should eat it, and we'll also be looking at how to reduce gut discomfort during exercise, proprietary methods to enhance recovery from exercise, and then finally a brand new newsletter that I have decided to start putting out on a separate website that you may be interested in if you currently subscribe to and benefit from the BenGreenfieldFitness.com newsletter. So, without any further ado, let's delve right into today's topics on BenGreenfieldFitness.com. And oh yeah, before I forget, I am going to answer one listener Q&A on aqua jogging. So stay tuned. Listener Q&A. Listener Craig asks, you say running posture should be lean forward, while other sites say posture should be straight and avoid leaning. Which is the right way and which is more effective? Now, this particular question from Craig was in response to my post on aqua jogging that I put up last week at BenGreenfieldFitness.com. And so I'm assuming that when Craig asks whether you should lean forward or whether your posture should be straight up and down, he is referring to aqua jogging indeed and not actual running gait. Now, when you're aqua jogging, let's make the assumption that you're doing it so that you can become a better runner. And the reason I'm making that assumption is because typically aqua jogging is used as a non-weight-bearing method to allow someone to train, for instance, through an injury. And bicycling also is a non-weight-bearing method that is often used hand-in-hand with aqua jogging. So I'm assuming that you're using the aqua jogging to rehabilitate a running injury or to stay fit through a running injury. Now, when you are running out on the road, if you have a straight up and down posture, a couple of things happen. Biomechanically, in your body, you tend to tilt your pelvis backwards, or do what's called a posterior pelvic tilt when you are running in a straight up and down posture. And what this does is it actually shortens your hamstrings, which attach to your pelvis, and it shortens your hip extensors, the muscles that are responsible for pushing you off the ground. By shortening those muscles, you're putting yourself in a state where you're not able to actually produce an optimal contraction or produce basically a ground reaction force for the push-off phase of running. Now that's one problem with being straight or slightly leaning back when you're running outdoors, not in an aqua jogging pool. The other problem is that when you lean back, the ground reaction force that pushes up against you when your foot strikes the ground is going to end up coming up and at you at a backwards direction when you lean back or when you're straight up and down. And what this does is it applies a braking effect to your body so that every time your shoe hits the ground is basically pushing you back. So essentially it returns to one of the laws of physics, which is that for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. Well, for every action that your foot strikes into the ground for you leaning back, there's an equal and opposite reaction pushing back from the ground the other way. So imagine that there's an arrow coming from your shoe into the ground. Whichever direction that arrow is facing when your shoe hits the ground is the direction that the ground is going to push back on you. So if your shoe strikes the ground and your body is over your shoe or you're leaning forward, the ground is going to push you forward. If your body is behind your shoe or you're leaning back or even straight up and down, the ground is going to tend to push you back. And so the reason that you would want to lean forward when you're aqua jogging is not necessarily because it's going to increase the metabolic benefit of aqua jogging, but because it's going to train you to run in a biomechanically correct posture when you return to road running. It gets you in the habit of leaning forward and having that slightly forward pelvic tilt and not the posterior pelvic tilt. Now, the reason that you would want to run in a straight up and down posture, or more of like a piston style running posture when aqua jogging, would only be if you're trying to get a little bit stronger from a bicycling perspective, because when you are straight up and down, it does use a little bit more of those cycling muscles, so you can pump the legs and more of kind of a high knee straight up and down running pattern and get a little bit of a cycling effect. And the other thing that you can do is you can strengthen the hip flexors a little bit when you're running straight up and down. So if you tend to have weak hip flexors, or you tend to have a hard time driving your knee up towards your chest when you're running outdoors, which is usually the case with weak hill climbers, you may want to actually enhance your aqua jogging session with some straight up and down running. And one of the workouts that I'll do is I'll do that straight up and down piston style high knee running, and then I'll do a regular lean forward running pattern afterwards, and it really trains the legs almost in the same way that it would if you were riding your bike and then you got off your bike and started running. So it's a great little way for triathletes to enhance their fitness in the pool. So great question, Craig. Hope I answered it. And remember, if you have questions, you can email me, ben@bengreenfieldfitness.com, or you can post your question to the blog by simply posting a comment to any of the blog postings there at bengreenfieldfitness.com. I'd love to hear your comments and your questions, and I've been occasionally sending a free book, a copy of one of my books, Shape 21 or 100 Ways to Boost the Metabolism, to people who ask a question. And that leads directly into another special announcement that I have for this week, and that is that at the website, 100waystoboostyourmetabolism.com, I know that's a mouthful, but it's easy to remember, that's just the number 100, and then waystoboostyourmetabolism.com, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes, I've started up a free newsletter. And basically, when you sign up for the newsletter, it's really kind of cool. Each week, you just receive a very short tip that you can use to enhance your metabolism. So, for example, I actually sign up for all my newsletters just to make sure that they actually work properly, and the tip that arrived in my inbox today says, "Welcome to the 100 Ways newsletter," and the tip says, "Not all cardio machines burn the same amount of calories." And here's how it goes. It says, "Not all cardio machines are created equal. If you want to maximize the amount of calories burnt during exercise, while also maximizing elevation of your post-exercise metabolic rate, you'll want to choose your cardio machines wisely. Think of the typical lineup in your local health club or exercise facility. The key is to rank the exercise machines in order of double whammy effect. What burns the most calories while you're on it? And what increases your metabolic rate for the longest period of time after you get off of it?" Now, here are, in order of effectiveness, 7 different cardio machines. Least effective, walking on a treadmill. Second least effective, recumbent bicycle. Those are the bicycles that you sit down on like a lazy boy. The next one would be elliptical, and that would be the elliptical with the legs. You're getting a little bit more effective when you do the elliptical with the legs. Even more effective when you do the elliptical that has both the arms and the legs. So you're pumping just a little bit more blood, burning just a few more calories. And then the top three would be upright bicycle, meaning the bicycle that you're actually sitting upright on, and that would be upright bicycle with hills. So not spinning at a super high 90 to 100 cadence, but basically pedaling a little bit slower against a heavier resistance. Second most effective, rowing or swimming, either one. And then the most effective way to burn calories and increase your metabolic rate for the highest period of time, and these are just measurements that they've done on people in the lab, is running on a treadmill with an incline. I know that's probably the least comfortable too, but if you only have a short period of time to work out and you want to get the most bang for your buck, that would be how you choose it. So it goes from walking on a treadmill all the way up through recumbent bicycle, elliptical with legs, elliptical with arms and legs, upright bicycle, rowing or swimming, and then the most effective, running on a treadmill on an incline. Although this will vary from person to person depending on weight, it is a rough estimate of how to get the most bang for your buck. And then the newsletter goes on and basically tries to motivate you to get out and exercise. But anyways, it's a great little tip that you'll just receive in your inbox once a week, and you can sign up for that newsletter at 100waystoboostyourmetabolism.com. Let's go ahead and move on to some of the exciting research on this week's podcast. Okay, let's jump right into things. First of all, a research study from the Gatorade Sports Science Institute. And this will affect you whether you are training for, say, endurance performance or sport performance, or whether you're just trying to make sure that you're getting through your workout in the best way possible. Basically, fueling your body so that you can achieve as great an intensity as you want to. Now, the research study titled "Does a High Carbohydrate Breakfast Improve Performance?" basically had the following key findings. Eating an easy to digest high carbohydrate breakfast 2 to 4 hours before morning exercise is recommended because it helps to restore your liver's glycogen stores after an overnight fast. Basically, when you're sleeping, your body burns through not really your muscles' glycogen stores, but it does burn through your liver glycogen stores. So it can enhance your endurance capacity. That means how long it takes you before you reach exhaustion. But it does not necessarily help you during high intensity exercise or during, in this case, a time trial performance. And so what you can take away from that key finding is that if you have a very long workout to do or a very long race to do, anything greater than about 2 hours long, so for like a triathlete, that would be like Olympic distance triathlon and up, you're definitely going to benefit from eating breakfast 2 to 4 hours prior, a high carbohydrate breakfast. If you have a short workout, anything up to 2 hours, that high carbohydrate breakfast isn't necessarily going to help you because it doesn't really enhance intensity that much. Now, my recommendation to a lot of my clients who are trying to lose weight is don't eat breakfast prior to your morning workouts because your liver glycogen stores are empty and because that will enhance the fat-burning enzyme, the rate of the fat-burning enzymes in your liver if you exercise when the liver glycogen stores or the liver carbohydrate stores are empty. But I would say, you know, that would only be if you are working out for fat loss and not performance or not prepping for a race that's greater than 2 hours in length. Now, another couple key findings of this study was that fatigue during prolonged heavy exercise is often associated with low or depleted muscle glycogen stores and with lower blood glucose. Well, this is kind of a no-brainer because if you're exercising heavily and you haven't eaten breakfast, your muscle glycogen stores are going to be empty. And the one thing that they did look at was whether or not there was actually an acute effect or an immediate effect on the glycogen levels of consuming breakfast. And it turns out that when you eat that high carbohydrate meal prior to exercise, and it's at least 3 hours before exercise, there is a significant increase in your body's storage carbohydrate levels, and that can really help you get through a long workout, a long race, or any exercise session for which you need increased energy levels. Now, Interestingly, another key finding of this study was that contrary to early reports, there appear to be no adverse effects on endurance capacity of consuming well-formulated carbohydrate solutions within the hour before exercise. Now, this is the interesting finding because I preach to a lot of the athletes that I coach and a lot of the clients who are doing workouts, that if they eat a high carbohydrate meal in the hour leading up to the workout, your insulin levels can rise and your blood glucose levels can rise, and that's followed by a subsequent drop in blood glucose levels, and you may actually enter into the workout slightly hypoglycemic. And while that may be the case, the studies actually found that there was no impairment of performance. And that rather performance was actually improved compared to a group that didn't eat anything at all in that hour before exercise. Now, the best case scenario in this study was to eat 3 to 4 hours prior to your workout, a high carbohydrate meal, or prior to your race, and then right before the race, 5 minutes before, consume something very sweet, a high glycemic index or a quick release carbohydrate. And so what I would say is, if you don't have time to eat 3 to 4 hours prior, then what you may want to do is just eat an hour prior, and you're still going to get some benefit from that. If you don't have to work out for over 2 hours anyways, and you have a morning workout, you may want to consider the fact that you might not even have to eat anything at all to get through that workout. So those are the results from the study, does a high carbohydrate breakfast improve performance? The next study was inspired by a lecture given by a guy named Dr. Jeffrey Spencer, who I'd like to actually get on this show in future podcast episodes. He's Lance Armstrong's personal massage therapist and one of the key factors responsible for ensuring that the cyclists in the Tour de France stayed injury-free during their day-after-day training sessions. And he revealed some pretty proprietary recovery methods, some of which I was familiar with and some was with which I was unfamiliar, on how to enhance your ability to bounce back from a workout day after day after day. And so these type of methods would reduce soreness and allow the muscle to repair much quicker. So what I'd like to do is go over a recent article that I wrote for the Training Peaks blog at trainingpeaks.com that includes some of the methods that Dr. Spencer presented during this presentation. So the first method that we can use for recovery is we can supply our body with the building blocks that it needs after workout. And I'm not just going to go out here and say the thing that you've probably heard a million times, that you got to eat after workout or that your body needs protein after workout. Instead, I want to get a little bit more specific. And my recommendation here is that after you work out, you need to consume, if you want to prioritize your recovery, something called a branch chain amino acid. And a branch chain amino acid is one of the types of amino acids that are very, very quickly absorbed by your body and used to repair the muscle at a rapid rate. And typically, you either get these as part of like a protein powder, you know, like a whey protein powder recovery drink that has branch chain amino acids added to it. Typically, something like that will also have glutamine added to it, which is a fantastic source as well, another amino acid that can be used for recovery. The other thing is you can take these in capsule or pill form. I do both. I have a powder, and the powder that I use is put out by a company called Hammer Nutrition. It's called Recoverite. And then I also use, when I'm in a hurry and I don't have a chance to find a good whole protein source like a whey protein powder, is I use a capsule. And the capsules that I use are called Recover Ease. I'll put a link to those in the show notes. But basically what I'll do is combine those with, for example, a piece of fruit to increase the rate at which the protein is absorbed, because when you consume a protein with a carbohydrate, it is indeed absorbed a little bit quicker. But they're called branch chain amino acids. And there is evidence that they can enhance exercise if you consume them during a workout. The problem is that you'll get GI discomfort, or you'll be very likely to get GI discomfort if you take them in sufficient levels to enhance your performance. So you'd have to take so many branched chain amino acids that you'd probably get a stomach ache if you take them during exercise. Your body has a little bit harder time digesting protein when there's blood flow going out to your muscles. Okay, recovery strategy number two would be ice. And specifically, the one that I'm going to focus on now is the ice bath. You want to save this for your key workouts, meaning if you have one very hard workout during the week, or if you have, for example, as an endurance athlete or as a competitive athlete, a very difficult game or race, you want to pull out the ice bath as a recovery method. Now, ice baths are a little bit uncomfortable. They definitely can cause that feeling of total body numbness. And it's logistically a little bit difficult to actually put together an ice bath in your house after every single workout. So I recommend when you walk in the front door after your long run or you've come home from a tough game or a tough race, you go to your freezer, take the tray of ice, dump it in your bathtub, go consume your branched-chain amino acids as you run water over that ice, come back, sit in the tub for 15 to 20 minutes. If you really want to enhance circulation even more after the ice bath has removed the inflammation, then stand underneath a hot shower as soon as you finish the ice bath. And I guarantee that will vastly decrease the amount of soreness, and it can enhance by several days your ability to bounce back from a workout or a hard race or game. Okay, the third recovery strategy, proteolytic enzymes. Now, these are the enzymes that are normally released in your body by an organ called the pancreas, and they're essential to the repair of your connective tissue, because your muscles basically look like World War II after a tough workout. And the connective tissue that's responsible for holding your muscles together and that basically runs through all the cells in your body can be what's called adhesed or twisted or torn or frayed. And proteolytic enzymes are one of the keys to ensure that the connective tissue is repaired. Now, the recovery ease, that stuff that I talked about earlier that has the branched chain amino acids, also has something called bromelain and papain in it. Those are two proteolytic enzymes. A couple more, slightly more effective enzymes would be trypsin and chymotrypsin, and you can get those also in pill or capsule form if you look at your local supplement outlet. Recovery tip number four, water. Now, when, for example, an ultra-endurance athlete or a Tour de France athlete crosses the finish line or finishes a day of hard training, they are given an IV to improve hydration, speed up the rate at which the body can actually replace all the water, all the fluids, all the electrolytes that were lost during training. Now, I don't recommend that you actually have a bag and a stick waiting for you at home so that you can give yourself an IV, but I do recommend that you try and simulate at least a small portion of that by getting lots of water, lots of electrolytes into your system as soon as possible after workout, and continuing to hydrate your body until you've replaced most of what you've lost during a workout. So hydration is not just for total body health, it's not just to keep you performing, it's to enhance your recovery. So hydration is essential to recovery. And then the last recovery method, one that I just literally did to my own body about 20 minutes ago, is something called a self-massage with either a foam roller or a stick or both. Now, in the absence of a stick, and I'll put a link to the stick that I use in the show notes. It's called a muscle track. I've even used a rolling pin. And all you do, it returns to that connective tissue concept, you roll up and down any connective tissue or any muscles in your body that are sore, and it actually helps remove a lot of the adhesions and a lot of the inflammation that occurs in the tissue during exercise. And you will be surprised at the instant benefit that this gives you in terms of decreasing soreness and enhancing your range of motion in a muscle. So you just roll over a muscle about 10 to 20 times. A full body stick or massage session will take about 5 to 10 minutes. Now, the other thing that you can do is you can use a foam roller, and a foam roller is just the opposite of you rolling a stick over your body. You're actually rolling your body over a giant stick, basically a foam roller type of noodle. I'll put a link in the show notes to a website called Perform Better, where I get all my foam rollers, and I have one long one and one short one, and typically the day after a hard workout, the morning after a hard workout, I'll just roll my body up and down that foam roller. You can hit the back, the IT band, the butt, the hamstring, the calves. So that's a fantastic tool to add to your recovery toolkit. So those are my recovery tips for today's podcast, and let's go ahead and move on to the next bit of research. And this is going to focus on your gastrointestinal tract. Do you have GI issues when you exercise? Or do you experience stomach discomfort that keeps you from working out, keeps you from exercising, and maybe even kind of disrupts your day a little bit? Well, there are certain things that can affect your gut that perhaps you aren't aware of. High protein, high fat diets typically have low amounts of carbohydrate and low amounts of fiber. That can affect the gut. On the flip side, a high carbohydrate diet can introduce too much fiber. That also can affect the gut deleteriously. Fad diets, I don't know if you've heard of the cabbage soup diet, different food combining diets, a raw foods diet, some of those can also affect the gut. Medications can definitely affect the gut. If you're taking an ibuprofen or a codeine, both of those, most anti-inflammatories can actually cause quite a bit of gut discomfort, as can several different supplements on the market. If you're doing like high-dose vitamin C, if you're taking Airborne all the time, potassium supplements can affect your gut, calcium supplements. If you're taking something that has a large amount of magnesium in it, most of the energy drinks on the market can introduce a very acidic environment in the gut. And even too much flaxseed, ground flaxseed, flaxseed oil can give you gut discomfort. High amounts of echinacea, high amounts of bee pollen. Now, a lot of the things that I'm listing are in popular energy drinks, popular energy supplements, popular, you know, metabolism boosting type of things that you may be on. So be aware that these things can cause some gut discomfort. And then some, even the natural anti-inflammatories, glucosamine, cayenne, ginger, those type of things. Go ahead and just look through the supplements that you're taking. Try and identify anything that may be contributing to gut discomfort during exercise or before exercise. Other things, eating habits that can cause gut discomfort, skipping meals, and then overeating, which has a huge effect on your blood sugar levels as well. Eating late at night, eating quickly, eating when you're rushed, consuming too much alcohol, caffeine, and very significantly, artificial sweeteners, especially things like sugar alcohols like sucralose, which is in actually a lot of health products, can contribute quite a bit to GI distress. So what you should take out of this is that there are many things that you could be consuming that could contribute to your GI discomfort. And some of my recommendations are to keep a food and a symptom log so that you can start to identify what might be contributing to that issue. Experiment with any new foods or fluids or food timing in your training, not in your competition. Choose liquids over solids if you have that option. If, for instance, for your pre-workout meal, you have the option of having like a fruit smoothie or a couple pieces of, you know, toast, for example. Choose the liquid food, and then always consume familiar foods when it's close to your workout or close to your exercise, your training, or your competition. Train your body to digest whatever it is that you plan on eating as a pre-workout meal or as a pre-race or a pre-game meal in the days leading up to that competition or that game or that race. So don't just try it out automatically during the race or during the competition. If there's a certain gel that you're going to be eating while you're exercising, then fuel your body with that gel during your training sessions leading up to that competitive scenario. Those are my recommendations on managing your GI distress during exercise. Now, the final bit of information that I want to go over is regarding a method that you can use to vastly improve your endurance levels with a minimum amount of training. And perhaps you've heard of HIIT training, which stands for High Intensity Interval Training. And the question is, how effective is that? Well, basically, when you train for endurance, what happens to the muscle is it increases what's called its oxidative capacity, which means that the enzymes that are responsible for taking the oxygens that you breathe in and converting it to energy, those enzymes work far, far more efficiently. The other thing that happens is you improve the amount of storage carbohydrate that you have.
you decrease the amount of carbohydrate that you actually use during exercise, so it's almost like a carbohydrate sparing effect, and then you also increase your capacity for using fat as a fuel. Now, the million-dollar question is there a way to get those adaptations without actually going out and spending 2, 3, 4, 5 hours of long endurance exercise? And so what researchers have looked into is whether or not high-intensity training can induce these same adaptations in a much, much shorter period of time. And so basically the definition of high-intensity interval training would be that you would do repeated sessions of a very brief intermittent exercise at a very, very high work intensity. That would be just from a few seconds, maybe up to several minutes, about a maximum of about 4 minutes in length. And these repeated efforts are separated by periods of rest or periods of very low intensity exercise. Now, the research that has been done on high intensity interval training has looked at sessions of anywhere from 10 seconds all the way up to 4 minutes in length. So we're looking at an exercise length or an interval length that basically kind of spans the gamut. And what has been found in research in comparing sprint versus endurance training is that not only can high intensity interval training cause the identical adaptations in the body that endurance training can cause, but it can also increase your VO2 max and your power to an even greater extent over endurance training. So basically, by performing high intensity interval training, you can actually replace that 1 hour cardio session or that 3 hour bike ride or that 2 hour run. And this is huge for those of us who have time limitations. There are actually some changes I'm going to be making in my own training programs based off of some of this research that I saw. And so what I want to do today is just give you an example of the type of workouts that were used in the high intensity interval training that actually caused these adaptations that were very similar to long endurance training. So, for example, a session used for cyclists was 12 30-second intervals at about 175% of VO2 max. The best way I can define that is that you are going at your all-out 110% effort as hard as you can go. So that's 12 of those 30-second efforts with a 4.5-minute rest after each one. So that's it. Another workout is 8 4-minute efforts at 85% with 1.5-minute rests. So we're looking at 12 30-second efforts at your very, very hardest intensity with 4.5 minutes between each one. That would be one workout. And you'd want to warm up about maybe 10, 15 minutes prior to starting these intervals. Another workout would be 8 4-minute efforts. So that's a little bit longer session, but compared to like a 3-hour bike ride, it's nothing, with 1.5 minutes rest between each session. Couple of other workouts, and I'm just actually scrolling through the workouts in this study as I record this podcast. Okay, here we go. Another workout that was used that was highly effective that was compared to a 60-minute exercise session was 4 to 6 30-second intervals at maximum intensity for 4 minutes, performed 3 times a week. They compared that to 60 minutes of endurance exercise at about 50-60% intensity, performed 5 times a week. So one group spent 1.5 hours during the entire week of training, and the other group spent 4.5 hours during the entire week of training, and both groups had the identical amount of endurance training adaptation, except for the high intensity interval group actually exercised about 90% less in terms of their training volume. And so a huge difference. And all they did was 4 to 6 30-second efforts with 4 minutes of recovery. Now, the key is that these efforts need to be very, very difficult. And most of these studies took place over about a 4 to 6 week period of time. And so, you know, for example, for 4 to 6 weeks, you would do 3 times a week very, very intense interval sessions. You know, you do 6 30-second efforts, take a 4.5-minute rest, do your 4 minute efforts with 1.5 minute rests about 6 to 8 times through. So that's a little bit longer session. But basically you take this HIIT training and you put it into your program. And so with all the programs that I'm designing for my clients now through Pacific Elite Fitness, I am actually removing a little bit of the volume, especially for the people that are able to handle the intensity, and freeing up hours and hours and hours of time for my clients, but still giving them all the benefits of endurance training. And it really is kind of a breakthrough in terms of the way that you think about your training if you're a triathlete or an endurance athlete, because you know, it's kind of a revelation. You don't actually have to go out on that 4-hour bike ride. You can hop on an indoor trainer and hammer through 12, 30-second intervals, and you're getting the identical adaptation. I do realize that there are other discussions to be considered. You know, how do you train your body for fueling? How do you train your body logistically to sit in a bike saddle for a long period of time? That type of thing that you may not get out of the high-intensity interval training. But for the most part, this should be added into your program. If you are interested in how you can enhance your program with this type of training, just shoot me an email, ben@bengreenfieldfitness.com, or submit a question in the show notes to this podcast. And so that's basically all the information that I want to cover today on the show. I realize that I did a lot of talking. I'm going to be going back into the interview format for the podcast starting next week. I'm actually spending my last couple of days here in Hawaii. One last thing, I did compete in the Hawaii Ironman World Championships a couple of days ago, which is the reason that I'm here in Hawaii. Didn't have the most fantastic race on the planet, but for those of you who are interested in tracking my racing and my training, and I post a lot of the workouts that I do, I actually have both a Twitter page at twitter.com/BenGreenfield. I also have a website for my training at bengreenfieldtri.blogspot.com, and you can check those out if you're interested in primarily triathlete training, endurance athlete training, and how to enhance your program with some proprietary methods of exercise. So check those out. Until next time, this is Ben Greenfield signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.